Hello and welcome to Lewis Needas Law and the Lewis Needas podcast. I'm your host, Holly Sonnebend, and today we'll be talking to Ian Coupland, Director and Head of Commercial and Litigation at Lewis Needas Law. Ian is a Director and Head of Commercial and Litigation at Lewis Needas Law Limited in London, having previously been a partner at two top 200 law firms. He has over 30 years' experience in dealing with all aspects of business and commercial law, employment, insolvency, litigation and regulatory law. He qualified in 1988. Ian is well known for his litigation expertise, including heavyweight contractual and commercial disputes, frauds, professional negligence claims and property issues. He has acted for many national and international companies and financial institutions and is well used to obtaining urgent injunctions, especially freezing orders both in the UK and in other jurisdictions. Ian has lectured extensively on the subjects of business lease renewals, dilapidations and remedies for tenant default to fellow lawyers and surveyors on behalf of various organisations. Ian also regularly advises clients on insolvency and restructuring scenarios and acts for insolvency practitioners. Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, Ian, starting with liquidation, what exactly is it?
Well, there are two types of liquidations. The one people will be most familiar with is the one where a creditor issues a petition to wind up a company, and that is called a compulsory liquidation. The other alternative way is when the company, by its shareholders, actually decides themselves to liquidate the company. There's no need for a court order in this situation, and that's called a creditor's voluntary liquidation.
And what can I expect to happen next?
So, in either scenario, whether or not the court has ordered the compulsory liquidation or the shareholders have passed the creditor's voluntary liquidation, a liquidator is appointed. And the purpose of the liquidator is to realise the company's assets, pay all the fees and charges arising from the liquidation, and pay the creditors as far as possible from funds allowed under a strict order of priority. The liquidator can either be an official receiver or an insolvency practitioner who has been appointed by the creditors. And often the insolvency practitioner works with a creditors committee who decide what can be done in order to try to realise some of the assets of the company. And sometimes insolvency practitioner asks the creditors committee to often fund their fees. So the liquidator will look at the circumstances which result in the liquidation to see if any fault can be laid at the door of the directors for either fraudulent or wrongful trading, which may result in personal action against the directors of the company, so that the liquidators can then take steps to try and recover monies which they have received. The classic example is when where the company has not been making a profit over various years, but nonetheless the directors have been awarding themselves dividends. And if that's the situation, then they're not true dividends, but in fact loans to the company, which the liquidator can then seek to try to recover. In all cases, the liquidator has to prepare a report and give it to the insolvency service. And one of the scenarios which the insolvency service, which the government body is to look after all companies, may well be to decide whether or not to bring director disqualification proceedings.
What are director disqualification proceedings?
So this is a situation where the insolvency service, usually appointing another firm of lawyers, will bring proceedings to say the director is unfit and should be disqualified for a period between 1 and 15 years, depending on the severity of what the directors have done. Those proceedings can be very expensive, and often if the director holds up their hand and says you have to have done something wrong, then at the end of the day they enter into what we call an undertaking, which means we don't need to do the court proceedings. The most important thing to remember from a director's point of view is whether or not they're found guilty in the director disqualification proceedings or agree the undertaking, is that if they do proceed to be a director of another company during the period of their disqualification, that is a criminal offence and they could go to prison. If this is a situation where there is a director's disqualification, but the director is working now in another company and it's vital that he remains a director of that new company so that that company remains in existence, to create profits for that company, to employ people. Then there is a specific application which can be made where you can ask the court, with the insolvency services approval, to be a director of that specific different company during the period when you have been made disqualified. There is some specific criteria. It is not easy to get this permission, but I'm pleased to say that on several occasions we have been successful in both persuading the court and the insolvency service that that's the right thing to do.
Can the proposed liquidation be challenged?
Well, to start off with, before we get to liquidation, where we're dealing with the presentation of a winding up petition, if the company does not believe that there is a genuine debt, or if the debt is not for £750, then they can apply to court to dismiss the petition. And if the winding up petition has been presented, one of the most important things to avoid from a company's point of view is the advertising of that petition in the London Gazette. That has to be done as part of the procedure at least 10 days before the court hearing. Now, the effect of the advertising in the London Gazette is that the London Gazette is read by all financial institutions, and as soon as the company's name comes up, banks and other financial institutions will freeze borrowings, freeze bank accounts, etc. So effectively, that's probably the end of the trading of that company. So if there is a genuine dispute, not only do you apply to court to dismiss the petition, but you also seek to apply for an injunction to prevent the advertisement of the petition, and that's very vital. So in terms of a creditor's situation, the advertisement is important because the creditor knows that the debtor, the company, does not want the petition advertised. So if it is a proper debt, what often happens is the petition is issued, the petition is then served at the registered office of the company, and the negotiations to settle the debt, to pay whether in one go or by instalments in order to withdraw the winding up proceedings, is done prior to the last date when the advertisement is made. And that's when the pressure is put on the debtor company to pay by saying, well, if you don't pay, we're going to advertise. And of course, if we advertise, that's probably the end of the company. So from a creditor's point of view, that's one of the tactics which is used.
And in legal terms, Ian, what exactly is bankruptcy?
So a bankruptcy, now we're talking about an individual rather than a company. And this can apply to individuals who are sole traders, individual people, or even individual members of partnerships. A bankruptcy petition can be presented by a creditor where the debt is at least £5,000. Compared to the company situation, there has to be a preliminary step of the service of a statutory demand, and then the bankruptcy petition can be presented to court at least 21 days after the statutory demand has been served on the individual debtor. If a bankruptcy petition is issued and then ultimately the debtor is made bankrupt, that's done by way of a court order called a bankruptcy order.
And can the proposed bankruptcy be challenged?
Well, yes, it can. If the debtor doesn't believe that there is a genuine debt, or that the debt is disputed and should become a part of some litigation in the county court, then within 18 days of being served with that initial statutory demand, the debtor can and should apply to the local county court to set aside the statutory demand. And if the debtor is successful in setting aside the statutory demand, then no bankruptcy petition can go forward on that debt, can't be presented. Clearly, setting aside the statutory demand involves, if you're not doing it yourself, but using lawyers, costs, and invariably the creditor will instruct lawyers, and therefore there's a full-blown litigation case, and costs can be ordered to the winner of that application, whether that's the debtor successfully setting aside the statutory demand or the creditor proving that they have a genuine debt.
What is the effect of being made bankrupt?
So when a debtor is made bankrupt, the bankruptcy normally lasts for 1 year. However, the trustee in bankruptcy, who can either be the official receiver or, just like in a company situation, an insolvency practitioner appointed by the creditors, can apply to extend the time. So, for example, further investigations are required. During the bankruptcy period, the debtor cannot be a director of a company. And also during that period, the debtor has to, or the bankrupt as they're now called, has to fully cooperate and provide full disclosure to the trustee in bankruptcy, who has very strong powers to get information, because from the date of the bankruptcy, all the assets of the debtor owned at that time by the bankrupt become owned by the trustee in bankruptcy. And that goes into the bankrupt's estate to pay off that person's creditors. The benefit of a bankruptcy for the debtor is that once the debtor has been made bankrupt, any debts which were due from a creditor by that debtor up to the date of the bankruptcy cannot then be proceeded with and chased once the debtor has been discharged from bankruptcy. So often there is a scenario where the individual themselves decides to make themselves bankrupt.
Ian, what is the individual voluntary arrangement and how does it work?
Well, now we're talking not so much about the creditor chasing the debtor for money. We're now talking about the individual who has financial problems trying to restructure their financial affairs, both for the benefit to pay the creditor, but also to give them some more time. First of all, the individual voluntary arrangement, or IVA, as it is known, as it says, relates to an individual. And that individual comes to an arrangement with that person's creditors to pay his or her debts in full or in part over a period of time. And this is done as an alternative to forcing the individual to go into bankruptcy. The arrangement has to be set up by an insolvency practitioner who, during the preparation process, is called the nominee, and then the proposal is put to all the creditors of the individual at a meeting of creditors, and if it is approved, then that insolvency practitioner supervises the individual voluntary arrangement proposal and is called a supervisor, the natural name. And one of the benefits of it is that if the individual does not comply with the proposal terms, then the supervisor is obligated to make that individual bankrupt. One of the benefits from an individual's point of view is that the individual only requires 70% in value of his or her creditors to vote in favour of the proposal, and then that binds the remaining creditors. So in that respect, it's an important scenario.
Is there any other benefit to do this?
Well, there is one particular benefit which works for people who want to do an IVA, the individual voluntary arrangement, because once the proposal is prepared, if, for example, there are court proceedings taking place or even bankruptcy proceedings being issued, when the arrangement is made, the debtor can apply to the court for an interim order. And that's done as soon as the proposal has been approved by the insolvency practitioner. And once the interim order has been obtained, then the bankruptcy proceedings are stopped, any court proceedings are stopped, any High Court enforcement officer can't go and try to recover goods by way of a debt. That interim order normally lasts until a period after the meeting of creditors, and clearly if the meeting of creditors approves the proposal, then everything's found, everything's bound, and there's no more litigation. But even if the proposal is not approved, there's sometimes the opportunity to put forward revised proposals within another 14 days afterwards. And in that situation, the interim order still applies, and it's like a protective bubble.
And how about a company voluntary arrangement? What is that exactly and how does it work?
Well, the company voluntary arrangement, or CVA, is as it says. This is very, very similar to the individual voluntary arrangement, but it's for companies. So once again, a proposal has to be prepared. An insolvency practitioner has to be the nominee, and then the nominee proposal is actually filed at court, and then if it is approved, again, by 70% in value of the creditors of that company, the proposal binds the remaining creditors, and the insolvency practitioner supervises and becomes the supervisor of that arrangement. The proposal again has to be considered at a meeting of creditors, and the creditors again can decide that they're not happy with the initial proposal and actually want to see variations of it, and again that can be approved either at that meeting or after a short adjournment at another meeting.
Are there any differences between a CVA and an IVA?
Well, the one crucial difference is that, unlike in an IVA, when I said that you can get an interim order to protect, to stop being sued, and you have like this protective bubble, you cannot have that in a CVA. So whilst the CVA is filed at court and it's all registered, etc., you can still enforce, you can still continue with litigation, and therefore, in some circumstances, not doing the CVA alone is not sufficient, but you have to do that at the same time as applying for an administration.
And lastly, Ian, what is the purpose of administration and how does it work?
So the administration applies to limited companies and partnerships and is intended to get the company or the partnership out of trouble and trading again if possible. An insolvency practitioner has to be involved and has to agree to become the administrator of that company. And going back to the CVA situation, as soon as the administration petition is filed at court, again, all proceedings, all debt collection chasing of that company or partnership stops. So that's why the CVA and the administration process are often used at the same time. So where a company wants to appoint an administrator, again, as I said, it can go and appoint a licensed insolvency practitioner. But also an administrator can be appointed by a licensed charge holder, like a bank who has a debenture, or the company, or its directors. The difference with some of the other processes where an insolvency practitioner has got involved is that where the insolvency practitioner is appointed as an administrator, the primary goal is to rescue the company as a going concern. But if this isn't possible, the administrator will try to get a better result for the creditors than would have been possible if the company was wound up. If neither of these is possible, the administrator will sell the company's property to make at least a partial payment to one or more secured or preferential creditors, such as employees or the bank.
Ian, thank you so much for your time. Where can people contact you with potential inquiries?
I can either be contacted on my mobile, which is 07712 875751, or alternatively by email, and my email address is icoupland@lewisneeders.co.uk.
That's all from the Lewis Needus podcast today. You can find us at Lewis Needus Law on Twitter and at lewisneedus.co.uk. Thank you for listening.